so it can work. And I'm like, okay, I want to be that disruptor. And this industry is ripe for disruption. And I mean that in the best way possible. I don't think the game itself needs to change. The people do, the thinking does. And if we don't, it would be such a shame if my son doesn't grow up playing this game.
Welcome to this episode of the Wild Golf Podcast. I am your host, Michael McDonald. My guest today is the inspirational and resilient Amir Malik, the founder of the Muslim Golf Association, or MGA for short, the world's first dedicated golfing platform that caters for the modern, professional Muslim male and female golfer. We follow Amir's journey in life and golf from the early death of both of his parents when he was a teenager, to having to grow up very quickly and pay the rent, to his university days and life in the city as a recruitment agent, to his spiritual journeys to Mecca, and his discovery and love of golf. We also discuss Amir's experience of racism in its many forms along the way. I hope you enjoy this discussion as much as I did. Amir, welcome to the Wild Golf Podcast. It's great to finally have you on.
Indeed. Thank you. Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Amir, I'd like to go back to, you know, the beginning and where you grew up. Maybe if you could just set the stage a little bit, where you grew up in the UK, you know, your family life and whether you played sports as a, you know, as a child.
Yeah, of course. So I'm one of four. I'm the youngest. I'm the baby in the family. Between me and my next sibling, there's 15 years difference. And then between the three of them, there's only 2 years. So they're all very close. So I was clearly a sparkle in my dad's eye. So I'm the special one. I grew up in a town called Kingston, Kingston-upon-Thames in Surrey. Beautiful, beautiful town. I grew up to pretty much first generation immigrants. My family, our roots are originally from Pakistan. But then they moved over to East Africa, to Uganda and Nairobi with the British, and then had a phenomenal opportunity to actually come over to the UK, almost forced because of the whole Idi Amin thing and what have you. There was a mass exodus. And so they came over and we were fortunate enough to land in Kingston. And so my sister, funny enough, she's 53. She's going to kill me if I get this wrong.
Or she'll kill you for actually telling her age. It's one.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Hopefully she won't listen to this. But she was born actually in Uganda, whereas my brother's born here. And so, you know, we've got quite a bit of a mixed identity. Usually a lot of people from Pakistan come straight to England. We kind of took the long route, which was through East Africa. So, and there growing up, you were just Asian. It didn't matter if you were Muslim, Sikh or Hindu, you were just considered to be brown, Asian. And I almost saw that growing up in the UK is that, you know, a lot of my friends, or not my friends, but my family friends and my father's friends and stuff, you know, we really didn't differentiate between someone being a Hindu or Muslim. And, you know, they would all speak Swahili. It was amazing. You know, I grew up in a household where they would speak three different languages and it was just like, whoa. And to this day, words that I thought were Urdu are actually Swahili, but we didn't know no difference because they were just sort of diluted into it. But my father, you know, he was some sort of mechanical engineer, and my mum was a housewife, and she, you know, she used to probably do a little bit of sewing and whatnot. But as I said, I grew up and I was the youngest of four. My eldest, you know, my brothers were, you know, 15, 16 years older than me. And so we grew up in Kingston. It was a council house that we grew up in. Very humble beginnings, but, you know, amazing childhood. It was always family orientated. My father was the eldest from his side. So we would always have gatherings. He was always the mediator and was always seen to be the head of the family. So we used to see the good, the bad, the ugly at my, and being again, the youngest, I was one who was dragged out at 11 o'clock at night to go with him to help sort out a dispute because I wasn't going to be left alone in the house. Of course, my brothers were out and whatnot. So yeah. But I had a phenomenal childhood, you know, growing up with a lot of my cousins, and sport was always a big part because, again, I had my brothers and they were big cricketers, big sportsmen. Actually, looking back, I probably had the school of hard knocks of being bowled at by 60. Well, I won't say they were 16, but they were probably what, in their late 20s as I was developing in my early formative years, you know, having to face that type of bowling. But it's amazing how that puts you in good stead. So when you go and play with people your own age, you're actually head and shoulders above them. But cricket was probably my first love. You know, I remember playing it ever since I was a child, and I played that throughout, you know, up until probably the age of 24, 25, on and off. You know, I started as a bowler and then eventually moved to a batsman and a wicketkeeper and what have you. But I always had a ball, whether it was in my hand or my feet. I could always turn my hand to any sport. As long as it was a racket sport, you know, I was always confident. Basketball, never. That was one sport, just never sat right with me. It just didn't work. But, you know, your traditional football, table tennis, badminton, what have you. So,
As a young kid and as a teenager growing up, did you have, you know, it sounds like your parents were, you know, really strong influences, but did you have other sort of mentors and, you know, and strong influences that, you know, gave you a value system that still sits with you, you know, today?
Sure. So I lost my parents when I was 14 and 15. So quite early on, my father passed away of a heart attack. He was 55, and 18 months later, my mum passed away of cancer. And so what I was told was pretty much she had cancer before I was born, but then it was dormant. And the shock of my father passing away, you know, triggered it back. And, you know, that was quite a distressing time, you know, looking back at it, because I was only, you know, 14, 15. And, you know, I literally had my whole world turned upside down. And I was at an age where, if I'm honest, I probably didn't know what a parent was. You know, they were almost seen as people that you go to when you want something. And even being disciplined, I mean, you know, my mom would be the far more heavy-handed discipliner, and my dad would be the cuddler. But, you know, if it was anything serious, my brothers would step in, you know, and that's when it would get quite military. And even those guys were quite chalk and cheese and stuff. But, you know, so I lost them at a relatively early age. And then I moved in with my oldest brother, who at a time was a police officer. In fact, he was a sergeant with the Met Police. So I moved in with him, and, you know, I was then 15, 16. And I had to grow up very quickly and become independent very quickly, because, you know, he was married. He was expecting his first child. You know, I look back at now, he must have been 30 odd. And he had to then take the responsibility of a 15, 16 year old, you know, teenager going through what he's gone through. Was never going to be easy. You know, I was rebellious to an extent, and in fact, I was rebellious full stop, especially with him and my sister-in-law. But, you know, I had it very open. I remember him, you know, saying that, look, if you want to study, you study, and if you want to work, you work. The decision is very much up to you. But just, you know, and he instilled very early on, you know, the concept of having to pay rent, for example. And back then, I was very much a case of feeling almost, okay, I wouldn't say hatred, but you're resenting. You're thinking, why are you, the little part-time money I'm making, you're taking it away from me, and why are you doing that? You know, but I look back at now and I think it's one of the most valuable lessons I ever had, because it's financial training, it's planning. I've got a family of my own, and whatever happens, I've got to make sure there's a roof over my head and there's food on the table. Coming back to your question, I digress in terms of mentors. I went through many different phases in life, I think, and at each scenario, you always had different people that I would necessarily look up to. I also was probably a lot more mature for my age, so I had a lot of older friends. I'd been naturally drawn to an older crowd, and even now I look back and I think I'm just constantly surrounded a lot of older people, which means my aspirations are mirrored to theirs. But then I forget that these people have got 10, 15 years life experience on me, and I'm wanting those things now, and I'm just like, okay, just, you know, just relax.
it'll come with patience.
It will come with patience. But ever since I was, you know, a young teenager, that's always been the case. I've always tried to be ambitious and push myself, also very independent, if that makes sense.
And did you know what you wanted to do then when you went off to uni?
I knew I wanted to stay in education, just because I could probably drag out freedom. And I didn't, you know, I've done every job under the sun, from packing warehouses to stacking shelves to working in a petrol station, a call center. There are very few jobs I haven't done, because I needed to pay my way, you know, I needed to support myself. So, but I knew I didn't want to go into work full time immediately. I, you know, tried a couple of businesses on the side and whatever have you. But I definitely wanted to go to university, because it was my escape clause. It was a way for me to leave London. So I went to college, wasn't the most studious, again, having a great time, but would just about scrape it through. Very last minute, did my A-levels, and then I ended up going to university, Nottingham of Trent. And I always wanted to do something business and related. Business studies was always the typical thing an Asian guy would do. And I thought, I don't want to do the de facto default thing, economics. You know, that's an advanced version of business, sounds better. Let's do that. And then I discovered how much maths was involved in it and realized I'm not very good at maths. And I'm thinking, oh. But anyway, I went to university and I had an amazing 2 years. You know, I was probably left with a small amount of money and I just spunked all of it. I didn't work and, you know, I had a great time. But that was, you know, that was probably a big turning point in my life, because once I completed my second year, it's then when I started really questioning, what am I doing here? What is all this about? You know, I'd seen the highs of highs, the lows of the lows, and met all sorts of people. And it was just, and it really made me question life, I guess, generally. And then I wanted to be an investment banker. I thought, that's my life. I'm going to get into the city. But then, like I said, math wasn't for me. And I thought, I don't really know, to be fair. I then decided to take a year out. I thought, I've got no money. I've got no one to go run home to and say, can you carry on funding me? So I thought, let me go back home, go back to my brothers. I'll take a year out. I'll just get a job. I'll save some money and I'll come back and I'll finish my third year. Came back, got a job as a call center operative. I think I was working for British American Tobacco back then, probably just doing stock checking with news agents across the country. I then got approached about a job in IT recruitment. I met someone and they'd also said, actually, you know, you can make a fair bit of money. I was hearing that you could make £5,000-£10,000 in a month. I thought, I only need to do that 3 months. And, you know, I've got enough money to go back to university. This sounds all right. And I got through so many interview stages. I'd always make it to the final stage. And I remember that the directors would never hire me because they said, well, you fell out of university. You know, what's to say that you're not going to give up in recruitment? And I was like, I don't think you understand. I'm Asian. If I don't have a degree, I need to have a lot of money. I need this job to work. There was one chap, it was a Sikh guy who just set up shop in Cannon Street, and he took a punt on me and he gave me a salary of £16,000. I was only earning 12 in the call center. I thought, yeah, quid's in, 4K up. And I started work with him, and there was literally, I was in a room, probably no bigger than a broom cupboard. And it was me and my director, and we would spend from 8 to 8, you know, Monday to Friday doing recruitment. And I learned recruitment, you know, side by side with him. I even remember my, I think it was 21st or 22nd birthday, you know, I was even scared to ask him, can I go home at 7:30? Because it's my birthday. But it was brilliant. It was an amazing 6 months. I learned so much. I got to sort of tap into my entrepreneurial spirit. Mm-hmm. I learned about the city. I learned about people. I learned about business. It was so many different facets coming into it. And it took me 6 months to start doing my first couple of deals. And in fact, I remember my first deal was an SAP consultant with EY, the consultancy firm. And I remember when I got this guy's job, I think he got me £100 Hugo Boss voucher. And he said, listen, I don't think you understand what this job means to me. Because his father was a consultant and his father was a partner. His brother was a consultant and he was almost seen as the black sheep. And he thought, if I didn't make it, it was always going to be tarnished. But he got the job and I was like, it's all right, this recruitment, you know, you get paid well, and you know, people look after you. So I then had a very difficult decision because I was doing well. Money was coming in. I thought, right, do I now go back and finish or do I carry on? Because I've invested, you know, 6 to 8 months doing this recruitment. I've built my market up. I'm seeing momentum. I'm actually making some very good money. What do I do? So I decided to defer and I deferred again and I ended up staying with him for 6 years. Phenomenal decision and experience. And we grew the business to 8 to 10 people. He was a great boss. I was lazy, but he still put up with me because I made good money. From there, I then had an opportunity to go and live in Mecca.
So during this period, so you're early 20s, you're learning all about people and accountability and, you know, assessing people and putting them in different jobs. And in all of this time as well, clearly you were, you know, growing up as a Muslim in the UK, and lots of things were going on in the world. You know, during that period, you know, we had 9/11, we had Afghanistan going on and the Taliban, we had the referendum in the UK with, you know, politicians, including our current prime minister, you know, saying very Islamophobic things. I mean, for somebody who's not a Muslim, I mean, can you give, you know, me a sense of, you know, what has it been like, you know, through those formative years, you know, growing up in the UK, and how has that changed maybe over the last 5 or 6 years?
So I grew up in a relatively moderate family. We were definitely Muslim by faith, by name, and, you know, hand on heart, there wasn't anyone who was devoutly religious. And by that, I mean, would pray 5 times a day. There was a lot of culture and tradition that was mixed up with the faith. You know, there'll be some amazing things that we would adhere to, but yet some of the basic principles we wouldn't, you know. So I grow up with a bit of an identity crisis? Yeah, maybe, because, you know, you're trying to fit in and you didn't really understand. So trying to navigate through those waters was relatively difficult. And, you know, I remember growing up, you know, I went to a racist school. 100%. There was probably only a handful, maybe 10, 15 brown kids in my secondary school. It was very much a sports orientated school. I'd failed my 11 plus. I'd gone to a great primary school, and no one from my primary school, apart from one person, came to my secondary school. So that told you a lot. But I went to my secondary school because my brothers had gone there. And when my brothers had gone, all those years ago, it wasn't a bad school, but now it had a really poor reputation. But again, my parents didn't know, you know, they English wasn't their first language. Well, my brothers did it, so you go there. But it was a racist experience, 100%. You know, there probably wouldn't be a week go by where you wouldn't have comments, fights, abuse, but you got immune to it. You stuck it to your own, and we grew up. And again, I was with Hindus and Sikh guys, and they didn't care, you know, whether you're Muslim or not. It was, you're brown, you're a Paki. It is what it is. And so we grew up with that. When I got to college, it was very different, because now you strength in numbers, right? And so that was never an issue. And people grow up and those side of things. But my faith would only come into play on a Friday. It was something that we'd always do. You know, the Friday is a congregational prayer. And no matter how far you are away from being a devout Muslim, a Friday prayer is just one thing you don't miss. You know, it's just something that's done. It's like going to church on a Sunday, right? It's just a done thing, regardless of what happened. So there was always that concept there. It's amazing. You know, you do all different vices, but you never eat pork, as an example, right? Or you might not drink, but yet you're doing everything else around there. So it's, you know, it's crazy when you come to think about it, right? So my faith was always there, but probably hidden. You know, it was always hidden in that side of things. But like I said, when I was leaving university, I started to really question things. I then got really brought into the city life and you know what it's like. You know, you work hard, you play hard. Did that for a good sort of couple of years, did a lot of traveling and whatever have you. But then again, you question, you think, right, there's got to be more here. There really, really does. And that's when I started to discover my faith in more depth and understand it and research it. And so in the background, we had 9/11. I was still at college when that took place. Didn't really mean a lot to me in terms of what was going on. I wasn't politically savvy at all, but there was Islamophobia. We grew up with it. I saw it. But again, I was sheltered because I was at university. You had your own things. And again, when we were coming into the city life, I didn't see much because I was in a small company, just me, my director, and a couple of people. So on a day-to-day basis, I was never going to encounter it. And on a train, I can only account on one or two incidences where a discussion might have come up, but nothing too heavy. It's only when I started venturing out into the bigger world that you start realizing that people's views are very different. And when you start going to different regions and realizing when they don't have too much interaction with Muslims, that they're just ignorant. It's just lack of education more than anything.
No, and London's very different than other parts of the world.
Exactly. It's so cosmopolitan, right?
And so how did your opportunity to go and live in Mecca come about?
That was phenomenal. I mean, I was engaged at that time. The engagement broke off, and it just, you know, and I was in a position where I just needed a get out clause, and everything just lined up at the same time. I was then doing some charity work for an Islamic charity. We were doing events and whatever have you. And one of the founders of the charity I became very close with, he was a serial entrepreneur. He was a highly educated British guy who'd gone out to Saudi Arabia, studied, but then just, you know, set up number of internet businesses, you know, was living in Mecca. And we got on, we hit it off like a house on fire, and we really, really clicked. We did some amazing things. He just approached me and says, well, what, tell me about recruitment. What do you need? And well, all you need is a laptop, a mobile phone, and an internet access, and I could do this job anywhere in the world. And he literally put me to the test and said, okay, well, I've got a visa for someone to come out to Mecca and come and work for me. What if I fund it and you run it? And I kid you not, Michael, within 6 weeks, I'd sold everything I had, and I was living in Mecca. It was around early November. I thought about it. I thought, yeah, let's do it. Handed in my notice. And by December the 26th, 27th, I was flying out to Mecca. And for me, I'd been a couple of times. I was very fortunate enough that I performed the major pilgrimage Hajj in 2010. And I'd done the minor pilgrimage Umrah. So it was a place I knew, but I'd only seen it as a pilgrim. And you only ever get to see small pockets. And the more I researched, the more I thought, okay, I think I'm going to go out and then live like a Bedouin. I honestly thought that my shower would be a hose pipe. I thought my kitchen would be a stove on the floor. And that's what I was ready for. I was like, okay, but it's Mecca, you know, it'll work out. When I went, I had the most incredible time of my life. Mecca is the size of Birmingham. The most central place is obviously the Kaaba, which is the grand sacred mosque, right? And it's the epicenter. So it's everything is associated around that. So it's almost like, you must know Birmingham, right?
Yeah.
If you imagine the ball ring is the grand mosque. And then you've got all the different districts and towns around it and so on. And then you've got the big motorway. It's exactly how Mecca was. And so when I then moved, we were living towards the outskirts. I was living in the swanky part. It's the Beverly Hills equivalent, where the grand sheikhs, the businessmen, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, my flat was a wing of a villa, right? I had two double bedrooms, three reception rooms, two bathrooms. It was just me on my own, by the way. And I was paying £300 a month. Yeah. So I was living like a king, right? I was single at this time. We had 4G broadband, internet banking, all the food was halal. There were AstroTurf football pitches. They were football mad. I could watch all the Premier League sport games at 3 o'clock kickoffs in the evening. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing, right? And the food was delicious. It was cheaper to fill up, and I did this, it's cheaper to fill up your car and 1 liter of a bottle of petrol than it was to buy mm-hmm. water. And then I had the opportunity to go to the Grand Mosque on a daily basis and pray. And people only get to do that once in their lifetime. So for me, it was formidable. And from a professional perspective, I got the opportunity to set up a recruitment business literally from scratch. And funnily enough, I was working the UK market whilst being based out in Saudi. So when I spoke to clients, I had an address in Harley Street. My website was slick. I had an 0208 number. We was all on VPN. No one had a clue I was in Saudi Arabia. And you didn't really need to meet all your candidates. You could have Skyped them. And if I had a major client visit, I would fly in. But you know, I was pretty successful, I'd like to think, from standing start. And I must add that I went out there commission only. I had no base salary. So talk about backing yourself. I look back and I think that was nuts. But I was earning pounds, spending reals, and we had a great time. So when I was there, I was thinking, okay, a year's gone. I think it's time to settle down. It's getting a bit lonely now. We need to start looking. Once I'd sort of put word out and ask people, you realize there was interest, but then when they started thinking about it, the talent pool shrunk incredibly because it's a great place to visit, but probably not to live. If you're a woman, can't drive, can't do this, can't do that. And then I started scratching my head and thinking, okay, well, I'm here now. And honestly, I'd sold everything. And my proposal to anybody was, this is home. This is where I intend to be for the foreseeable future. So you've got to accept this. And then I was, again, very lucky that my friend's wife said, well, look, we might know someone. She's actually quite keen on coming out there. Why don't you hook up? So I had a conversation with her family and her brother. And funnily enough, they were coming to do a pilgrimage, but I was leaving Mecca. So we sort of sliding doors thing, missed each other. But we had a great conversation. Then, you know, her brother said, look, next time you're in London, why don't you come over, meet us, and let's get to know it. And so I was on my way back. And then I said to my brother and sister, I said, come on, look, there's someone I'd like to go meet. Went there. We spent a good couple of hours. That was the first time I met my wife. We hit it off, I'd like to think. I got a very good picture of who she was, what she was, and, you know, the family's got on. And once I left, 3-4 conversations later and another meeting when I came to London next, we agreed to get married. And within 6 months, we got married. And it's 8 years on and one child in, and we're still going strong.
And how old is your child now?
My boy, Abdullah, is 5 years old, 5 going on to 15. And then she came out there and stayed with me for about 18 months. And, you know, looking back at it, she had a wonderful time. She'd move back in a heartbeat. You know, everything that you hear and see, women are treated like gold out there. It's any place in the world I know that a woman could walk at any time at night and not get trouble. No one would do a single iota of anything bad. They'd always get privilege. They'd always get pushed to the front of the queue. It's just, there's a big misconception that was out there. But yeah, it was a wonderful time. But you miss your family. You miss your friends.
So eventually you came back. And at what point with all of this going on, did you actually try golf for the first time?
So the first time I actually tried it was with, again, my boss in my first recruitment company. You know, being a sportsman, I was always intrigued by it. I knew about it, never played it. And he goes, well, why don't you give it a go? And so I thought, okay, so I think we went to the driving range once or twice. In fact, I think he actually took me to a golf course and we played about 9 holes. I can't even remember it. And then we sort of left it. I never did anything with it again. It was just forgotten about. And then I started to research it even more when we were in Saudi. It was amazing in the sense of we found a golf course in Jeddah, and it wasn't a green site. It was a brown site, right? So it was an 18-hole course.
So with sand greens.
Yeah. And so what you do is you carry a piece of turf, and wherever the ball lands, you pick the ball up, put it on the turf, and you hit off it. And all the greens would always be back to front sloping because they'd be raised and made with oil and water and whatever. And it was crazy. And we would go around in his Jeep, and that would be our buggy. And you'd just drive around, and you'd have to play very early in the morning. So just after, you know, the Fajr prayer, we would drive up to Jeddah, and like madmen, we'd play it. So I did that a few times. And then we thought, well, we can't keep doing that because going to Mecca and Jeddah is about an hour and a half, 2 hour drive. So we thought, well, why don't we build a sim? So we imported a screen. We got this OptiShot, you know, device because it was only the cheapest thing we could. And then we did that for a couple of weeks, and then you get bored and you think, okay. and then golf really didn't. And then I didn't really touch a club until I came back to the UK. And that's when my love affair with golf started, and we've never looked back, to be fair.
And so at what point did you look at golf and really say, I really love this? And then as well, what was it that drew you, you know, to the game? Because clearly now you're, you know, probably one of the most passionate people around about the game of golf. So something must have happened that was life-changing as far as golf is concerned.
I think so. And I think, I don't think there was necessarily a pinpointed time, but I think it was definitely a build-up. It was never I didn't get this passion because I hit a great round. I think what happened, I actually graduated in the game of golf from you start off in the driving range, you then go to the pitch and putt, then a 9-hole, and then you venture out onto some sort of golf course. And then you realize that actually there's a difference between a municipal course and a championship course. And you're like, oh, am I ready? Am I ready? But I was very lucky when I came back. I made some amazing lifelong friends, and we almost went on this journey together. We're competitive. I'm so competitive. No matter what it is, there's got to be a winner and a loser, right? And so we started playing, and we were all progressing roughly at the same sort of time. And we got into it more and more. Now, I was living in Luton, and my friends were all back in Surrey. So every weekend, like a madman, I would travel 2 hours just to go play golf, right? But you don't care. I would go, and we would just play and play and play. And then we decided that actually they then got their uncles and their dads involved. And all of a sudden, there's about 10 to 12 of us, but we would only ever play together. Forget joining a club. That was never going to happen. We weren't brave enough to do that, right? But we would go play guest fees or whatever. Then the idiot in me, who's always looking to do more, said, why don't we go abroad? It looks amazing to go play in the sun and this and that, and let's go Spain. And so we did. And so the youngest at that time must have been 24. The eldest must have been about 55. So we had such a wide range group, and we went for about 4 days. I think our first trip was probably 3 days. I think we played 2 rounds in 3 days. But the bond that we built over those 3 days is probably what has inspired the MGA, because again, we were all of a very similar level in the sense that we'd all found religion, and religion was now a big part of our life. We would pray, we wouldn't drink, we wouldn't gamble, wouldn't go to the nightclubs, and golf was a great release for us, and it really brought us together. And so we would, you know, we'd do all fun things, we'd go swimming and whatever, and into the sea, into the beach, but we'd always get grounded. And so because we'd pray together and eat together, and after each prayer, we'd almost just give a reminder to one another, just about life, right? Just to, you'd recall about your experience, and it'd be an opportunity to listen to someone who's older. I mean, we had a guy who was managing 500 people for the Home Office. And then you've got a guy who's a student, you know, and they're just giving their own little analogies and life lessons. And I thought, and I'd almost come away from that golf trip, reignited in my faith, inspired as a human being. It was a wonderful trip, and the golf wasn't great, but it didn't matter. But you were still playing in a great time. And we did that for a good number of years, Michael. And each year you're getting better at the golf, but also the reminders are getting far more interesting. The brotherhood is getting far more deeper. And that's when I started realizing that I've got something very special here. And that there's two things that unite us. It's the faith and golf. Without the golf and just the faith, I wouldn't have gone on a trip with these guys. And if it was just the golf and not the faith, I would have never met these guys.
Yeah.
So the two for me really went hand in hand. And, you know, we became closer and closer. And that for me was the inspiration for the MGA, because I thought what I've just experienced is what I want to share and I want others to experience. And now I'm becoming more devout. And I'm now starting to see the nuances that come with golf. I'm getting better at it. I'm playing far more courses across the country. I'm getting more intimately involved in this game. And then I start seeing the ugly side, mm-hmm. which is the alcohol, which is the drinking. I'm seeing the gambling, and I'm just thinking, that's not golf. And golf in its pure sense is a phenomenal game. Yet there are too many people of, you know, who I would say are born Muslim and associated with it, and are just falling into that trap of thinking they have to conform and have to be like that. And I'm like, that's not the case. But I can't keep telling people you can't do that unless I don't create an alternative.
Yes.
And I wanted people to feel proud. And again, I was very lucky that I guess I'm pretty confident, you know, I can say no and you know, sort of you stand up against the status quo. And I just thought, right, I've got to create an environment where there people have an alternative and people have a choice and they don't just have to do what's always been done. And again, through this journey, you know, the better golf courses you go to, I see racism. I felt it. I've experienced it. You are looked down upon. And I wasn't going to stand for that because I'm thinking, who are you? And if anything, most people at those clubs aren't very good golfers, actually. and that's what really wound me up is how do you even have the audacity to even look down at me when you can't even play this game very well? And it's not until you strike that first ball off the tee that they then just go, oh, he can play. Right. And when they see a bearded guy, yeah, and I'd like to dress the part, don't get me wrong.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
I wouldn't turn up looking like an idiot. You know, I'd make sure I've got the gear, but I wanted to make sure I knew what I was doing and how I could play. But there was hostility. There still is hostility, you know, not as bad as it would have been 20 years ago from what I've heard from other people. But, you know, and so over the years, the more I played, that's what really inspired me. The MGA then became an experiment because I was then intrigued to see, I wonder how many other Muslims there are across the country. Because like I said, when I was playing in different parts, I was coming across, you know, just a couple of people. And I thought, oh, you play golf. And because it's not a conversation, right? Cricket, yeah, 100%, right? If you're Pakistani and cricket's definitely coming up. If it's not cricket, it's football, but golf, no chance. So when someone did say golf, you're just like, oh, and they would almost think it was so exclusive for them that no one else would do it, that they wouldn't even talk about it, right? It's a bit like Fight Club,
yeah.
that sort of scenario. So I thought, okay, I went to my brother. I said, listen, I've got an idea. I want to do a charity golf. I'm doing golf day, mm-hmm. actually. I'm dying to see how many Muslims there are because I think there's a fair few of us. And he was working for Reed and still is working for Reed Foundation. And he was their philanthropy manager. And it's a charity that's close to me because they provide education for orphan children across the world. And I thought, brilliant. Let's organize a charity golf day. Let's see who turns up. If we get 20, 30 people, great. And if we can raise a couple of quid, no problem, but let's see. So I chose the Grove.
And this was about 2 years ago, is that right?
This is in 2019 now,
okay. Yep.
2019. So I'd heard about people organizing charity golf events, but there was nothing really catered for the Muslims. Mm-hmm. So there would still be alcohol, but it'd be like a no alcohol zone sort of thing. And like the Muslims would sit there and if you didn't want to drink. And I just thought, nah, man, if we're going to do it, let's do it properly. So I thought, right, let's pick a classy venue, the Grove. Perfect. Okay, they had a great charity package. So I went to the charity and said, come on, why don't you sponsor it? We'll do it in your name, but we'll call it a Muslim charity golf day. And then that's when I came up with the organization of the Muslim Golf Association, MGA. It was a bit like Ron Seal. It does what it says on the tin. Okay, and I wasn't going to hide from it. I created the website. I wanted it to look slick. And again, having spent time with the entrepreneur in Saudi, you realize that, you know, life really shapes your experience, builds you up for the future. I learned so much from this guy. And, you know, and you talk about a mentor. He was my mentor and still is, you know, I think I've only ever told him once, but I learned so much from marketing, development, technology, the lack of fear and just going out and doing something, that everything that you see with the MGA is actually, I owe a lot to him. And so I set everything up. I set up the website, the hosting, I did the payment plan and whatever. So I thought, right, let's launch this on Christmas Day, December the 25th, 2019. And the event wasn't going to take place until June 2020. I look back at it now, I think, what an idiot. You're launching an event 6 months in advance. Who does that? Right. But I thought, sod it. Because I'm so impatient. I thought, I can't wait that long. Let's just do it. I did it. And like within 24 hours, I had 72 people paid for, signed up for an event 6 months in advance. And the ticket was £110. It wasn't cheap. Yep. Right. It's not like a 20 quid job. It was, you know, it's a lot of money.
And how did you spread the word so quickly? Was it all social media, word of mouth, a bit of everything? No.
No, I'm not anti-social media, but I just can't be bothered with it. WhatsApp. I thought I knew a lot of people. I that's when I realized I think I know a lot of course, or I know yes. people who know people.
Yes, yes. And as you would do from being a recruitment agent for so many years.
Right, exactly, right? And so it's my nature to know people, but I just put out a message. And I knew that if I've got a cool website, because I'd seen how people have done golf days, and it's crap. It's so poor. And all of a sudden, the website stuck out. The pictures were great. It was done nicely. And everyone was just like, yeah, let's do it. And then within a week, I had about 90 people signed up on a waiting list. And at that time, I was actually on a retreat, right? So I'm on a religious retreat, my detox, and my phone is just going ping, 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 ping. I couldn't focus, right? I'm just thinking, what is going on? This is crazy. It's like, oh my God. I was buzzing. It was incredible. I had to put the waiting list on. And then within a week, I had 90 people. And then that buzz died down, right? And I think, oh, I've got to wait 6 months for this event to happen, right? And yeah, that was the start of the MGA. And my only bugbear is I have to say it was founded in 2019, but it's like, oh, it was the last 3 days of 2019. Can't I say 2020?
And so you were able to have this event at the Grove. It was a big success.
Yes. And well, COVID hit, didn't
yes,
it?
Yes, of course it did. Yes, yeah.
COVID hit, and I thought, oh no, what do we do here? And no one was used to this. So I was in constant communication with the Grove. We ended up then deciding to push the date back. I think we pushed it to August, and we were one of the first events, major events that they held with masks, 4 to 6 to a table or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And I've got to say, it was a tremendous experience. They put on a great show and they did the best they could. We didn't get the full Grove treatment because you couldn't. But it was a phenomenal day. I had 72 people from all across the United Kingdom come down, people I've never met before, just playing. We took over. We had a shotgun start. No, we had a 2-tee start, but you know, we had halal food and we raised £18,000. We had over 35, I think, orphans sponsored. And that's when I then realized that actually there is a lot of Muslim golfers, very good golfers as well.
And maybe we could just talk about the event. So what did you have to do, obviously, to make it, you know, work perfectly, you know, from a Muslim perspective? Obviously, no alcohol, no gambling, and you had to have, you know, prayer facilities of some sort there. And how did you do that? Because obviously, you probably prayed before you went out, maybe on your round.
That's right. So it was all carefully timed, because as a Muslim, you pray 5 times yes, a day, and it's done according to the sun, right? So the summers, you've got longer time and there's more time between the prayers. And so we were teeing off, and it was a bit of a dilemma. Is that, do we pray before or after? Have we got enough time? What do we do? And so we had a staggered start. And so the more religious guys, I said, right, you go off first, because you'll know that you can pray and when you need to pray. And then what we did was then said, okay, we were out on the green. We just laid out some mats, but I'll never force anyone to pray, because that's between them and their Lord. Like I said, we just make it available and make it comfortable. And so naturally people then, before they teed off, would go and pray in congregation. They were encouraged, and that was it. You know, it's generally not rocket science or anything like that. We just ask people to be respectful. They know alcohol is really easy. You know, you just don't serve it. And we've got halal food, which most places actually, especially hotel resorts, already have halal chicken. They just don't advertise it. And so it was relatively pretty easy for me to do from a Muslim's perspective, but it's just, you know, the way you package it.
And at that point, so you do this successful charity event. Did you have a sense then of what you wanted the MGA to grow into?
That was a long period of 6 months where I had a lot of thinking to do, and my sort of vision was starting to form, and is still forming shall we say, in terms of where it's going and what I want it to do. The plan was always to try and solidify it for the men and to build a good standing, but also just put on a good show and create a high level of service and experience. If I could create the experience, then people will come back and they'll tell others. And that was always my mantra and always has been. And so I even got signs made for the tee, for the first tee signs. You know, I look back at my first pictures and think, yeah, I wanted people to feel special, right? And it's almost the concept of a corporate golf day, but plugged in with brotherhood and a family sort of feel, but just make people feel special, because that's all people want. And so I got the signage made. I then went out and bought big flag banners, pop-up posters. I got a couple of MGA t-shirts made. You know, I spent a fair bit of money because I wanted people to come in and think, this isn't just some idiot and some Mickey Mouse guy trying to, actually, I wanted people to feel a sense of belonging and professionalism, because the people that I was tapping into were senior professionals. You know, they've got money, but they've got a certain level of expectation. And I didn't want to disappoint, because unfortunately in the Muslim world, we talk a good game, but don't always deliver. And so I just wanted to make sure we exceeded that. And so, yeah, that was always the thinking behind it.
And so this past year, I guess, would have been your first sort of quasi-normal year. Maybe you could give a sense of what the year was like, the sort of events you put on, and maybe a bit about the race to Arden and how it all has panned out. Because it sounds like, similar to the charity event, it was, you know, oversubscribed from the get-go, and you had, you know, more things, you know, more people than you had necessarily events and capacity to make it all happen.
Oh, 100%. And in fact, you know, again, when we did the charity event, a part of me thought this could go well. They're going to need and want something else. So I then booked the Belfry and I said, okay, I'm going to bring you 144 people and we're going to have a 2-day event and a stay over. So I got that package together, got it ready, got it signed off. I delivered it on the charity golf day. I launched it, and within about 4 weeks, we sold out. And that was to take place in October, but then lockdown hit hard and I had to completely cancel. And in fact, it cost me money because I had to refund everyone, and the payment providers weren't going to refund me their transaction fee. So I was down a fair bit, but I took it. I thought, okay, it's a risk I took. It is what it is. And I was lucky that some people actually said, you know what, keep the money. I know you're going to do another event. We'll come to it. And then that's when I started planning for 2021. I thought, right, we need to do something big. I've got a demographic all across the UK. We need to do something in the north, in the Midlands, and in the south. And I thought, What can we do that's going to link them together and create some sort of consistency feel? And my aspiration is always looking at the PGA and the European Tour. If they can do it, I can do it. And that's what my model was. And so I thought, right, why don't we try and find three courses under the same name and same brand and try and do something? And that's when I approached the Marriott. So I thought, perfect. Hospitality venue, hotel, great golf courses. Then you realize that they work in clusters. There's naive me thinking all the Marriotts would be under one management. No, that's really not the case. I'm thinking, oh, great. So, you know, they only had a limited pool and whatnot. But I was so lucky that they were brilliant. They were so welcoming, and you know, they took the time out to understand what I wanted to do with the MGA, and they were delighted to partner with me. And I said, look, let's do one in Manchester. They had Worsley Park. I wanted to then do one in London. We were going to do Hanbury, and I hope they don't mind me saying it, they were too expensive. I didn't think it was worth the money. So I said, okay, let's leave that. And then we did, the final was going to be at the Forest of Arden in Birmingham. And then that's when I thought, right, let's do it, the Race to Arden. We'll do a tri-series event. We'll finish it off in the Midlands. It's got a great ring to it, and let's do that. And so we organized Manchester, and then I approached the Shire in London. Fantastic course. When I met with them, you know, I met with Kai, and we just hit it off. I had a great 2-hour conversation. He was already talking about the diversity aspect of what he was doing with the Muslim community, and they were just so welcome. And I thought, yeah, this is where I want to be. And the course is stunning. You've played it, right?
I haven't played it. I'm going to be there tomorrow.
Fantastic. Listen, it's like on a hot summer's day, it's like you're in Spain. Mm-hmm. It genuinely is. Sevi's done a great job in his 666, 63, 64, 65.
Yeah, and I think
65.
It's the only course he's actually properly designed as well.
Yeah, that's right. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful facility. And the greens are beautiful. So you'll have a great time. And so we did that with the Shire then. As always, very nervous when you come to launch an event. Are people going to take it? It's the first time I'm going to Manchester. It's the first time I'm going to Birmingham. What's my marketing strategy? I only had a website. I didn't do anything on SEO. I didn't do anything on Facebook. I didn't, in fact, I spent nothing on marketing. I just, the power of WhatsApp and contacts and communication, and it got sold out within days. And it was like, whoa, okay. In fact, it was oversubscribed. And then in the meantime, I still wanted to do things properly. So I signed up with Golf Genius. I went and paid a subscription. I said, if we're going to do the handicapping, we've got to do scoring. We've got to do it properly. All the resorts are using Golf Genius. That's what I want to use. Let's do that. I was then in the background applying to the World Handicap System, to England Golf. I said, right, I want to be a registered tournament provider, because I didn't want to get involved in handicaps, because I've seen too many societies fail because they fight over handicaps. So why not stick to a uniform system? Mm-hmm. No one can blame me. Blame England Golf. They cut you, they give you shots and so on. So we went through the due diligence process. They accepted me, which was a major tick box for me. I was like, wow, that's huge. You know, who am I? I'm sitting in a bedroom and, you know, I'm now an official tournament provider, you know, fair play. So that was massive. And in the background to all of this, Michael, I'm now starting to see that actually there is a lot of problem with golf and diversity. And going back a couple of years, you know, you had the Black Lives Matter. And I'm going to digress a little bit, because I'm going to talk about my personal work now in terms of my day job, is you start really realizing that actually there's a lack of diversity, not only in sport, but in life and in the corporate world, massively.
Absolutely.
As you'll know better than anyone, I'm so proud to be working for a business, of my business, called Michael Page, who I genuinely think are the pioneers and leaders in trying to tackle diversity, that gave me the confidence to really come out and go on the front foot and attack the golfing world, should we say, for the use of a better word, because I realized that everybody talks a good game, but there's very little action. And you've almost got the wrong people trying to provide the solution. You talk about lack of females. You've got men talking about lack of females and the problems with lack of, you know, not having women on the board or in decision makers, but there's not a woman talking about it. You know, that people are talking about the fact that they don't have enough black people in their organization, and you've got white guys talking about it. It just didn't make sense. And then you've got, you know, you've got white guys trying to find a solution for black people. You've got men trying to find a solution for women. It doesn't work. And that's, again, big inspiration for me, is that, okay, I can talk the talk. I've got to do something about it. I can't just, you know, just conform to everyone else. And so that gave me the confidence. I'm on the shadow board at work, and that was set up because we've got an all white board, a couple of females, but they're all white. And so our business took the view that you can't get rid of the MDs. You just can't, right? But we can set up a shadow board who will be the soundboard. It will be the platform where new ideas will be generated. Voices will be heard. It'll be made up of ethnically diverse people, different genders, sex, backgrounds. And together we can start doing things. And having been part of it really gave me the inspiration and the empowerment that change can happen. Because now the ideas I'm presenting at work are being listened to by senior MDs, CEOs. And I'm thinking, that's a FTSE 250 business. Okay. I feel empowered. And so I almost took that arrogance, shall we say, and said, actually, golf really does need to change.
And when you compare it to corporates, you're right. I mean, in some sectors, there's been disruption, but golf is so far behind.
It's so fun. And it was fascinating to see from a marketing aspect, communication aspect, an events perspective, from a diversity perspective, the industry is 30, 40, 50 years behind of what's going on there. And I think that's how I've managed to sort of push myself forward. I haven't done anything revolutionary. There are so many people out there doing better tours, bigger tours, but I look at their website and I think, it's all great. I look at their communications, I look at their marketing and think, okay. And I'm no marketeer, but small differences make a huge, huge impact.
Well, that's wonderful, because as you know, unless, you know, people like you step up and actually voice, you know, what they want to have changed, you know, things won't change. We need people who are disruptive like you, who can help make it happen.
I hope I can be an inspiration for others, because I'm nothing in this.
You're one person, but you're doing a lot as one person.
I'm trying, but you know, and again, because I was recruiting and still am recruiting in the startup world, you know, that's influenced me, because it's disruption. It's like, you know, I saw the banking system collapse. You've got Monzo. Monzo don't have a single building, and yet a phenomenal bank, right? So it can work. And I'm like, okay, I want to be that disruptor. And this industry is ripe for disruption. And I mean that in the best way possible. I don't think the game itself needs to change. The people do, the thinking does. And if we don't, it would be such a shame if my son doesn't go out playing this game.
You know, you made the comment that, you know, it can't be men or even Muslim men, you know, telling, you know, the Muslim women in the MGA, this is what we think you should do, do it. And I know that you have said on your website as well that this is, you know, created and designed, you know, by women for women. And maybe if you could, you know, say a bit more, because I know that you've had a pilot scheme, you've had introductions, and you created a safe environment where Muslim women can at least pick up the game as beginners. But I'd love to hear a lot more about what you're doing there.
So the men was always stage one, the women is stage two, and the kids are stage three. And again, my wife, she wears hijab, she wears an abaya, which is almost a long robe, relatively moderate stroke conservative Muslim. And I thought people like her need to be playing this game, and she doesn't. Right. But I thought, okay, this game is perfect for Muslim women, because if you think about the attire, the format, the concept, the technique, there is no reason why a woman, and I was now looking to model this. And if we take the most conservative Muslim women, and by that I'm talking about someone who wears a niqab, so you could only see her eyes and she's fully wearing a robe. If I can get and model the game that she can play, then everyone else becomes easier, right? And so that's my model. And I look at it and I think, well, what she's wearing, first and foremost, will not prevent her from swinging a golf club, 100%. She's playing with three other women, perfect, right? She doesn't need to mix with men. She gets exercise. It's a game of intelligence, skill, great camaraderie. This is perfect. She doesn't need to do much to change her attire. Whereas if you think of football, cricket, swimming, you know, there's a whole different dress code because you just physically can't do it. Then I thought, okay, I'm not equipped to deal with the women's side. I need help. I need to go and seek partnerships. And then I got introduced to Love.Golf, to Alistair Spink, and we hit it off. Because here is someone who, again, ironically, being a guy, just realized that there is a lack of female golfers. The industry is dying, but here is someone who's doing something about it. And he came up with Love.Golf methodology, which was ultimately, because he's a PGA coach, is to change the way people think about teaching golf. And we've got to go back to the element of how people fell in love with golf, and they fell in love with golf on a golf course. And so when I heard his story, I thought, amazing. That's me. That's you. You've got the research. He's got the experience. And when he went through the methodology of how he gets people and women, only women playing the game, I thought, that's the model and vehicle that I'm going to use. So we spoke, and because he's backed by Syngenta, we then spoke with Syngenta and we said, okay, again, Amir talks a great game. Let's see, you know, we don't know the Muslim audience. I mean, they struggle. I don't say they struggle, but you know, it's still difficult to get white women playing golf. You know, it's not easy, let alone a brown woman, let alone a woman who's Muslim and wears a headscarf, when you don't see that. It just doesn't go. And I thought, no, we are going to break this. Okay, I'm confident in my network. I'm confident in my community. I know what the women are like, and they just need an avenue. And now I've created this safe platform, which is the Muslim Golf Association, because it's created by a Muslim. Yes, I'm not a woman, but I will make sure there's a woman coach. I will make sure that if this methodology works for a woman, that it doesn't matter what color you are, it will work for you fine. The only thing I'm going to put in there is that we've got to make sure that she can be taught. Like I said, let's get the most conservative woman. If we can teach her, make her feel safe, then we're on to a winner. And so we launched our first event earlier on this year. We decided to do it at Stonebridge Golf Club because that's where Hannah Crump, amazing, amazing coach, amazing, amazing woman, influencer, inspirer, was going to lead the session. I launched on a Sunday evening, 7 o'clock. We only had 25 slots. I say only. I mean, even Alistair, and he won't mind me saying this, was probably hesitant that I was going to even sell out. By 9 o'clock in the morning, all the places had gone. Mm-hmm. And I'd put a fee of £20 because I was including some fee onto it, some food, sorry. By 9 o'clock in the morning, 25 spaces, all paid for, all signed up. Within a day or two, we had about 40 women signed up on a waiting list. And I'm thinking, what? And everyone's jaws just dropped, and they're just thinking, whoa. and the rest they say is history. I mean, on that day, you'll see the video on the website. If you go to the women's section, there's a 3-minute video. Nothing was edited. It was a before and after, and it was a phenomenal experience. When you're hearing words of inspired, it's not changed my life, but it's changed my perception. It's opened up a brand new avenue. And I got my cousin to come. She's an individual who recovered from cancer, but still has, you know, some long-term illnesses. Lockdown had hit hard, you know, was probably struggling to get out and about. You know, she had the courage to come. Again, she wore the headscarf, and Michael, she has got the golf bug.
That's great.
Oh my God. She genuinely has told me that it has changed her life, because now she feels she can go out. She's met new friends. She's got the confidence. She's got that, you know, that spark back in her step. And she feels she can do anything. And I'm thinking, she's only played golf a few times. And that's a true life story. And that for me is just so inspiring. I'm just thinking, how many other women have we held this back from? You know, I had a 60-year-old woman come, and this woman was so resilient and inspiring. You know, she wasn't weak, but, you know, we gave everyone a golf bag with about 4 or 5 clubs in it. And you could see she was, you know, she was struggling to carry it, but she was so resilient that she didn't want anyone else to carry her bag but herself. And she carried that bag for 3 holes. And I looked and I thought, that's a woman who's been through life. And you could just learn so much. And she came back with such a smile. And, you know, I thought maybe that's what my mum would have been like. So yeah, it's been wonderful.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant that you've been able to do that in such a short period of time. So what does next year look like? Because I imagine you've got more things going on with women. And you also mentioned that, you know, you're going to focus on kids at some point, which is great. You have a son who probably will try to play golf at some point.
Indeed.
And it would be great too at some point to have, you know, a sort of fantastic young kid who ends up being a good golfer, getting a scholarship, you know, to play wherever in the States, and who knows, a tour player at some point.
100%. My world has opened up. I've almost made this now my personal mission. It has taken over my life. I can't think of anything but golf, MGA. What started as a passion still is, but, you know, I think I found my calling. I want to take this global. I mean that. And, you know, I'm not going to say that I talk for every ethnic group or wherever. I am Muslim. I don't talk for Islam. I don't talk for Muslims. I don't, you know, but I am, my religion is my way of life, and it's so compatible with golf. And golf has given me so much of life skills, values, friendships, sports, just a different way of thinking that I want to share that with the world. And I look at it and think there's not a single Muslim player on tour. It's sad. And, you know, I want to create an MGA Golf Foundation, which will be a fund that will support all aspiring players from anywhere across the world to go and make it. And so they don't have to worry about it, because it is a privileged sport, but there's a lot of money in the Muslim economy. And if there's a platform that people trust, then I will create that fund to support them and really get a Muslim. My preference is a woman, just to smash the stereotypes, because could you imagine seeing a professional player on tour with a hijab, mixing it with the best of them? I mean, if that doesn't break stereotypes, I don't know what will, and if that won't act as an inspiration.
And ideally winning an LPGA event in the Southern US, I'd be
could you imagine?
I'd be giving you high fives over that.
And can you imagine what sort of inspiration she would give to girls across the world that you can do it? So 100%. My next plan is we're going to solidify, you know, I'm not going to swamp the UK with events, because you lose that prestige and attached to it. Next year, I'm looking to still do a tri-series, but I'm going to introduce a Ryder Cup. So if you don't win your division, the top 8 get selected. So you'll either represent the North or the South, and then you'll be invited to play the Ryder Cup sort of format. I want to go to America, North America, Canada. And I think we can replicate what we've done in the UK for the men and the women. Mm-hmm. I want to do that there, South Africa. And then I eventually want to make my way across to the East. Candidly, I want to get the credibility and the pedigree of having not necessarily conquered, but established myself in the West, and then take it to the East, because it's still, there's a lot of ex-British colonies. Golf is still only played by the elitist in those countries like Pakistan, India, Malaysia. It isn't accessible at grassroots level. They're 30 years behind where we are today. So that's going to be a different battle I'm going to have to try and face and challenge. But we'll come to that later, but I've got to try and get some respect, pedigree, kudos behind me so that when I do approach them, I'm just not some guy who's trying to do good for the world. I'm actually coming with a bit of substance.
And I like the fact too that you're, you know, you would branch out, you know, places like North America, you know, I think even Australia, New Zealand, you know, countries that have, you know, fairly large Muslim communities.
Yeah.
And like, you know, the MGA, you know, fairly progressive as well, like, you know, rather than, you know, going first to places like Saudi or wherever.
Yeah, 100%.
I think that's a wise way to do it.
America, come on. It's, you know, I'd love to go play in America. I mean, I went to New York. I fell in love with it. I thought it was a great city. And that would probably be one of my first destinations. Yeah. I've looked at Liberty, I've looked at Bethpage, and then I start realizing that actually it's probably not as cheap as I thought. And it's like, oh. But it's fascinating just from the research that I'm doing, you know, it seems like a very close shop, you know, just I'm only looking at it from the outside, but, you know, we're here to disrupt, we're here to do things differently. But I want to be able to create opportunities because I know they're progressive. You know, they're probably a little bit ahead in terms of a Muslim community in the golfing world than we are here, but why not? And then if I can create the franchise or the brand in America and Australia and South Africa, then eventually I want to create an international cup. Let's get all the countries and all the MGAs around the world, and we'll have a four-day invitational where we just get everybody united. And that's where my plan for Saudi would come into play, because I think you can mix religion and golf. And with Mecca, with my affinity, Mecca will always hold a very sacred place to every Muslim in the world. But why not come and perform a pilgrimage and then go play golf?
Yeah, no, I agree with that too. And I think that clearly in North America, at the, you know, the private clubs can still be as conservative as anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
But, you know, people know that the, you know, the private golf environment is such a small fraction of people in the world who golf, and you can do
indeed
so much, especially as a beginner, because there's nothing more intimidating than going, you know, to a club atmosphere, particularly if you're a woman and a person of color.
100%. And my, to say battle, I mean, you're gonna, you know, I've really got to get some PR exercises here, but you know, my calm is never going to be, my battles are never going to be with the private clubs, because they will always be what they are. And if we focus on them, you're never going to win it. It's at grassroots level. I mean, I'm a member of a municipal golf course here, and it's run by the council, and the potential is immense. If we could have the United Nations array of flags of the amount of nationalities we represent within a 2 to 3 mile radius of where the golf club is, we have so many different ethnic minorities that we could introduce to this game. I think we could have the golf club of the year, of how diverse, of how open it could be. But it just requires a bit of foresight, planning, collaboration. And that's where the game is really going to grow. Because for me, I think you graduate from these places. You naturally do, because, you know, these places shouldn't have any rules. They shouldn't have any dress codes. There should be no barriers to entry. It should be as low as possible. Get people to fall in love with the game here. And if they love the game, they appreciate the game, they will respect the etiquettes over time. And then when they're ready, they will think, okay, you know what? I now want to go test myself in maybe a different environment. And that's maybe where the private clubs or the semi-private clubs can then start opening their doors. But you know, you almost graduate through that process. Leave the private institutions as they are, because if you're going to get wealthy, then they'll always be there. But at the grassroots level, I look at the manufacturers, I look at the R&A, and I know it's all about money, but this is a wealthy sport. You know, do I want to have my model golf club one day? Yeah, I do. And I'd love to go and try that out someplace. I've got loads of ideas, but that's where the game really needs to be invested, in my opinion.
I guess one question I'd like to ask you before we come on to the rapid fire questions is that, you know, if you were in charge of the R&A, let's just focus on the UK at the moment.
Sure.
And you're also in charge of golf generally, every private club, every public club, every driving range. What sort of 3 or 4 changes would you want to make to golf? And assuming that this could all get implemented overnight if you waved your wand.
Wow, what a question.
To make golf, you know, more welcoming, you know, and accessible, you know, for Muslim men, women, and children.
Sure. And let's take the Muslim out of it, right? Because for me, it's not just about Muslims. It's about ethnic minorities. It's people of color, different backgrounds, right?
Yeah, I agree with that.
And so what would I do? I think you've got to go out and first of all, understand your audience and the people that you are trying to attract. Do not for one second be ignorant to think that you know it all, and so on. So go speak to people and not, you know, if you live in the middle of nowhere in Scotland, you know, you can't expect to be a diverse club because you just don't have that community, right? So first and foremost, look at your community and the RNA, I would really champion them to go out and empower clubs to actually, you are a focal point and a community venue. It's a sport that, first of all, does not discriminate and should never discriminate. It's available and accessible to everyone. Learn your community and reach out to them and almost make the club a haven to attract people to, from a young age all the way through to the old age, because it's sport you can play from the age of 5 to 95. Okay, as long as you're fit enough or able enough, you can, right? And by that, I mean able in so many different ways. I would ask them to have revolving committees and really see what they give back to a community. I think that is so important. And that will give you an idea of how much they are reaching out and what they're doing. You know, just embrace change and welcome change. Have subcommittees. I think junior people need to be listened to. The kids that are in love with the game should be given a voice or at least a platform of respect and said, well, talk to us. Too many old guys are trying to make decisions. It happens in mosques, Michael. It happens. Too many people become institutionalized. They don't want to give up that seat with all Jewish. They've got nothing better to do. It's the only thing they can feel that they've got some sort of power in. But that mosque and this game doesn't belong to you. You're just a custodian. You've got to hand that over. And if you don't listen to the young generation, they will move away. And they will go somewhere else. And it's the same concept I would have. So have a shadow committee, listen to your youth. They will feel empowered. They will stay longer. And you might find that you're a club that's moving with the times. So, yeah, I mean, off the top of my head, that's probably something I would look to do.
And there are, I mean, there are one or two, there's not a lot of clubs out there like that, but there are some who radically ask their members what they want, including, you know, the kids. And they actually give them what they want. and the response isn't, you know, no, we're not going to do that because this is what we've always done, which is what we typically get at a golf course.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. And it's just, look, I get it. It's human nature to hold on to things, right? Especially when you've been involved in something. No one wants to see some sort of legacy or something they've been built destroyed. But any corporation, any sport, any institution, everyone's got an end of life date. If a company wants to reinvigorate itself and tap into new audiences, you've got to move on with the times, right? You've got to have a new CEO. You've got to have new ideas. You know, golf's no different. It's just we've kept them for too long because it's what you do when you retire.
Yes.
And it shouldn't be like that, unfortunately.
I agree with that. So we have to finish up with some rapid fire questions, Amir.
Sure.
And then I'll let you get back to your young family.
Thank you.
So what has been your wildest golf adventure or experience, whatever definition of wild you want to use?
My most wild one was probably playing in Saudi Arabia off a, you know, probably 2x2 turf at 6 o'clock in the morning, driving with a Jeep's boot open with clubs flying out, and staying away from a sand blizzard was probably the most craziest thing I think I've done.
And where would you go for your own personal golfing pilgrimage?
The States or New Zealand, just for the scenery.
And what's your biggest passion outside of your day job and golf?
It was Arsenal. That went a long time.
not so much anymore.
Not so much anymore. I think it's my faith, if I'm honest. Mm-hmm. I do. It plays a massive part in my life in so many different facets. You know, I'm still involved with the charity I think that would be my next best passion.
And lastly, Amir, if you could fly a banner around the world behind an eco-friendly plane, what would your message to the world be?
It would probably be education is key. Education is key. And always think good of others.
That's a great one to end on. Amir, thank you so much for your time. You've been very generous. And your passion comes through for the game of golf and what you're doing for you know, the community outside of the MGA, and I wish you every success this coming year, because I'm sure the MGA is going to go on to bigger and greater things.
Thank you, and thank you for the platform. It's so nice to just speak to someone and about it, and yeah, rant. I think my wife is probably welcoming that I'm speaking to someone else. So no, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Wild Golf Podcast with Amir Malik. If you like this episode, please tell your friends and leave a review on your favorite podcasting service. Our guest next week is Emma Ballard, the editor of the Woman in Golf digital magazine. See you next week.